Hey, Pulp fans, thanks for your support. Whether you're subscribing to the podcast through iTunes, visiting pulpmx.com, streaming the show via the Stitcher app on your smartphone, or buying from our show sponsor, btosports.com, without you, we could not do this. You can still type M-A-T-T-H-E-S upon checkout at btosports.com if your order is $100 or more for a discount. Lastly, for some insider info and maybe a laugh or two, follow Mathis' Twitter updates at twitter.com/pulpmx. Water's clear and my ears underwater, taller and hum from the car.
Disclaimer.
During this episode of the Steve Mathis Show, there is a high
chance ability
you will either learn something
a lot of people don't know,
you left thinking,
duh,
or make you say to yourself,
dude, that's so funny.
The bottom line is,
this podcast serves as archival
documentation
of this interview.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast Show. As usual, I'm your host, Steve Mathis. With me on the line is a guy that I would classify as a friend of motocross, and that's Eric Pernard, longtime promoter slash friend of motocross, I guess. Huh, Eric? Did I cover it?
Yeah, that's a pretty good description, because every time I get caught in some political feuds regarding motocross, at the end I say, you know what, at the end of the day, I'm a friend of motocross. That's what I want. I want to see successful motocross, supercross, endurocross, you name it, everything with a cross in it and two wheels. So it's it's a really good description.
And you're originally from France years ago. Let's go into your background a little bit. Talk about your background a little bit so people get some information on you.
Sure. I mean, I was pretty much born a few years ago, you know. I mean, it would be 50 years ago this year, so it's a big anniversary. You know, just a lot of my good friends like Mitch and Brock, we all turning 50 this year, so that's fun to talk about. But at the end of the day, I was born in France about 50 years ago. I was in the French Alps. I was a skier. I was at the beginning of extreme wave of skiing, and then I discovered a motorcycle, and that was the end of my skiing life as I knew it. And coming from the cold, we had two things we could enjoy. It was mostly riding a motocross bike when it was no snow, and riding skiing when you had plenty of snow. But very quickly, I found ways to make motocross my 12-month hobby, you know, throughout the year. So, you know, I started to ride in the mid-70s, and very quickly I fell in love with America, and I decided that I would move to U.S. and become part of the motorcycle world in U.S., which I did quite well, you know, because I became part of that world. Mm-hmm. But in '79, I followed André Malherbe, at the time one of the best riders. He was not a world champion yet. Came to the Trans USA for a few months, followed the entire series, and had a great time. You know, met Roger Lackey, you know, all those guys from 1979. Even Mitch Payton, I met him in 1979, and in 2005, thanks to Jim O'Neill of O'Neill Distributing, that gave me a job. I moved to US and became his one of his export manager, basically. And you know, then after that, it was a lot of work in the motorcycle industry, and
How did you meet Malher? Like, were you just going because you were France? He's Belgium, so how did that sort of connection come together?
Exactly, I went to Redbud, you know, in July. I mean, it was nice. It was in September '79, and there was only two European on the field. It was Malher and I, you know, and Malher was riding. I was watching. It was pretty lonely at the time, you know. Europeans were not very popular in numbers, you know, and we became friends, and I became his buddy, and we tagged along for a few races, and after that, we saw each other many times, you know, and actually, ironically enough, when I was working at O'Neill, he was O'Neill number one rider,
exactly,
so I was taking care of him in 85, 86, yeah.
Yeah, what's funny is that, Malher was the number one guy in all those ads in America. Back then, you know what I mean? He was a world champion three times, I think, on Honda.
Correct, yes.
I always thought, like, I always got the impression, and I, just a kid in Canada reading Motocross Action, that he was a bit of a sourpuss, a bit grouchy, hard to deal with. Obviously, your memories probably aren't the same, huh?
You know, he definitely was not the easiest guy to work with, mm-hmm. but I never seen a champion that was the easiest guy to work with.
That's a quote of the year right there. You're right about that. Well, maybe MC maybe.
Yes, you know, Jeremy and Ricky actually were pretty easy to work with.
Yeah.
You know, they were extremely professional, and mm-hmm. we never had any issues. But what I mean is, a champion has in himself a pretty big ego that he requires to be a champion,
exactly.
And that makes those people different than you and I. You know, and it's and we love them. That's the way it is.
See, Eric, I've known you for a long time, and I had no idea you worked at O'Neill. So it's a good thing we do in this show.
Exactly. A lot of people work at O'Neill. It's been an excellent school, you know, because Jim O'Neill is extremely passionate about the sport, and he gave a chance to a lot of people just by looking at them and see a couple sparkle in their eyes with knobs on it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then also there's a story about Jackie Vermon and his championship party that went awry, right? That you're
Yes. Actually, when I moved to U.S. in 85, I was with Jackie, and I was kind of tagging along with him. You know, we all like to tag along with riders. Mm-hmm. They are the people that we love. And we came here just before he became world champion, and we did the Golden State and all those series. He was one of the first guy to train regularly in U.S. Mm-hmm. during the winter time. So it was very interesting. We had fun experience, you know, and we were surprised how Yamaha USA was lacking support for a world champion contender.
Right.
You know, it was we had some interesting experience. One time we even had to buy a bike because we couldn't get one from Yamaha USA at the time. So it was then. This is now. Different management, but it was a shocker because, you know, I was so used to see the American riders being treated like gods in Europe, you know, and I was part of the people that treated them like gods, that when we came here and we realized, wow, it's pretty different here. But it was mostly different time, different management, you know. Things changed, you know.
Yeah, Ross Maeda has a good story of watching Vandervin, who, you know, was a 125 world champion.
Yeah, of course.
Vandervin's in Florida racing the winter series, and he's just... Bob Hanna has no idea who he is. And he's like, this guy's pretty good. Like, who is he? You know? And everyone's like, that's Kees Vandervin, like one of the best sand riders ever. And Bob's like, I never heard of him. So, you know.
Yeah, that's America for you.
Right, yeah. No, it's kind of funny.
I'm sure a lot of people are wondering how to say Ken Roczen, but I'm sure they're going to learn very quickly.
You're absolutely right. Well, I think as both, you know, I'm Canadian, so it's super close to America, but I'm, you know, I understand the American way of thinking a little bit, just like you. We both live here in America. We've made our lives here in America, but it is true. A lot of Americans don't follow over there. They're not a worldly people? And of course, it's a general statement, but, you know.
No, I think you're right, and I don't think none of us, since we love where we are and we respect everything that is happening around the U.S., we still have an outside view, and it's interesting what you said, because it is true, and especially when there is a very strong domination,
mm-hmm.
you know, like motocross has been dominated by U.S. for close to 20 years now,
yeah.
you know, and at that stage, I think America has a tendency to become quickly self-centered, and I would say rightfully so. In some words,
right.
you know, if everything is happening here, yes, it's easy to be self-centered. You know, I mean, in the soccer world, we're not self-centered in America because it's not happening here.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a good point.
It's
right.
like hockey in Canada. You know, it's pretty self-centering there.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, there's a fierce patriotism about hockey and how it's our game up in Canada. You know what I mean?
It's our
game, and like, it kind of strikes me as funny because I'm just like, really? It's your game? Like, you know? But it's just the way it is, and maybe it's like that with motocross down here. It's our sport when it really isn't. But you know, you can't blame them because Americans for years dominated. But
we're talking about hockey. Another interesting trivia: I played hockey for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was you know, in the Alps, you play hockey, you ski, and
yeah.
you wait for being old enough to buy a dirt bike.
mm-hmm. Yeah, right, huh? And then, well, I guess right around that time, you know, I feel like the Americans around the mid '80s, when you were with Vimon, Americans were far superior to the Europeans. But right now, we're at the point where it's as close as probably it's ever been since the late 70s, early 80s, right? Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it was a matter of track dedication. The,
mm-hmm.
the U.S. tracks were harder. I mean, motocross became harder in U.S. quicker than in Europe. In Europe, for many years, it was. I wouldn't say the old-fashioned way, but
mm-hmm.
you know, tracks were more like a road racetrack without the pavement. You
right,
know,
right.
Very fast, less jump, less, you know, obstacles. And I think the American became so good at being stronger.
Right.
You know, and nowadays the gap has been reduced to very little because the tracks are much harder in Europe, just kind of like more like U.S.
Right.
And I think people, are, you know, it is that kind of a supercross meet motocross at
mm-hmm.
some point.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Supercross was a fantastic platform for the U.S. motocross to get better.
I agree,
you know?
Yeah.
And Supercross carried motocross in many ways as far as elevating the level of riding,
yeah.
you know. That's my take. That's my 35 years in the sport take.
I went to Germany last year for the Teuschental GP, and I was blown away by the MX2 guys. How much they look like Americans. Roxen,
yeah.
Musquin, Forsard,
Herlings, yeah.
Just scrubbing. I don't know if Herlings raced that day. He might have been too young still, but just scrubbing and attacking and just looking like they belong on a supercross track, looking like any American rider. And I wrote that in my column. The MX1
yeah.
guys, you know,
yeah.
Philipparts, Caroli, Coppins, they all looked, you know, kind of stiff, old school, but the MX2 guys, whoo. Like,
yep.
you know,
I it's funny because I went to that GP this year and I saw that at the same track, you know,
yeah.
it was a lot of American style youth
yes.
and
yes.
I mean, American style ridings, you know, and it's been very interesting to see that the way the riders, even they built before, they were kind of strong. Now they're very light,
mm-hmm.
you know, they look more like Barcia. Then
yeah.
they look like the old-fashioned guys, you know?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Everybody would rag on the Thorpes and Malherbes for their riding style, but that's gone. That's long gone.
Yep.
Okay, so let's get back to Vimon's championship celebration, which really ended his career. You know, he finally wins the 250 world title, and
yes.
And then what happens?
He won the world title, and he was racing for Yamaha. Yamaha basically rented a very exclusive club in Paris named Latin Paradise, Paradis Latin in French, And he was supposed to be hoisted from the ceiling, you know, down to the stage. And there was some wrongdoing, and the hooks and all the proper harness were not done, not prepared properly, and he fell like 40 feet down on the stage.
Oh.
So I was very fortunate in a way that I missed it, you know, and that's something you don't wish to see, of course.
No, yeah.
But I was really good friend with Jackie, but it was my wedding weekend, so
oh, wow.
I had a good excuse.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
On the other hand, I went and spent my honeymoon by his side at his hospital in North France. You know, we went to see him,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, spirit was great, but it's nobody knew at that time how much damage it did to him, you know, because it's always this kind of situation when you get hurt mid-season, and everybody's scratching their heads about, you know, is he going to go back? What's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And Yamaha was extremely loyal to him. They did a lot of good things for him, but it was never the same after, you know. It's just one of the things that changed his life, you know.
Yeah.
And he walked away from it, which is the best part of it. But it definitely was a turning point. He was on the roll. He was ready to be multi times world champion.
Yeah.
And
that's
really a tragedy. It's bad luck. It's not much that can be said about stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, he raced a few years later, but you're right, he wasn't the same guy. And what a bummer for France too, because he was such a French hero. Right?
Yes,
yeah.
and he's a great person. On top of it, he's really a great champion. He was extremely courteous.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of those guys like Jeremy, you know, and that is really making an effort to go out of his way to make everybody happy and smile.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, definitely a great champion.
He's one of those guys that I see around. Saw him at Bercy. See him over here quite a bit at Supercrosses. I always want to go up and talk to him and interview him, and I never do.
You should. We'll set you up this year in Bercy for that.
Yeah, I would love to just talk to him, you know, just like I'm doing here. Just talk to him about his life and his career, you know. Okay, so your Vimond, your French hero, is stricken down, and you're in America. What goes on from there? Are you just working at O'Neill?
Yeah, working at O'Neill for about a year. Then I got a big offer to switch to Thor.
Oh.
You know, so
wow.
I went and worked with Bob Maynard,
mm-hmm.
you know, for a while. But the San Diego scene, that was, you know, that what we were used to call the El Cajon connection at the time, you know, was, you know, I kind of, maybe I my priorities were not right, and I may have been partying a little bit too much, and we're not working enough at that time. I was hanging out with all the guys we know, you know, my age, the Rickies, Scott Burnworth, Brock, you know, and all those guys. So it was definitely a good time, but that didn't work very well on the professional side.
Yeah.
And I ended up, you know, on my own, and fortunately it's the time I met my wife, so it was all good. I was not a sad puppy. Oh, it was very, I was very happy, and we decided to start our own business. And funny enough, I was a journalist. I was a motor journalist, and I was what Le Big is today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was for Motor Review and Motor Vert in 86, 87.
Hi.
And it's how I met Xavier.
Mm.
And I mean, I knew Xavier before. We knew of each other.
Right.
But in 87, I met Xavier face-to-face at the USGP in Carlsbad, and he asked me to help him with Bercy. And that's pretty much started my Supercross career, you know,
right.
at that point. Because I started to organize everything, you know, delivering, paying,
mm-hmm.
Feeding, transporting, you know, I mean, all the logistics around the Supercross. And that became a big part of my life, because then going in that direction, in the early 90s, I was working with five or six Supercross in Europe, you know,
right.
on a regular basis. I mean, there was a lot more races at that time. You know, riders were making as much money racing overseas as they were making in U.S., and the business was thriving. You know, there was Milano, there was Sapporo Race, there were Geneva, we had Basel, we had Barcelona, Madrid, they were racing in England, it was like a race in Belgium, it was really a busy time.
And you were the U.S. liaison for all these guys.
Exactly. I was the U.S. producer. I was, right. You know, I mean, everybody, each of my customers had different requests, you know. Mm-hmm. Like for Paris, Xavier tells me who he wants, and I basically take care of it. But for Geneva, I do the entire, you know, U.S. Mm-hmm. team together alone. You know, I mean, the promoter just tells me, hey, this is my budget, get me the best guys you can.
That's
the end of the story. So it was different with every promoter, because every promoter has his own style, and some people like to be involved, some people don't like to be involved. But and slowly but surely, I lost one after the other because the race didn't exist anymore.
And now you're down to two, basically.
Down to I always help Genoa with Paul. Mm-hmm. You know, Paul Lindsay is in charge of Genoa, and I always give him a hand, you know, because he hasn't done it as long as I've done it, and mm-hmm. if I can help him, I'm glad to do so. But today I'm basically working with Xavier for Paris, and I'm running Geneva, and it's still very excited. I'm still very excited about it. So, you know, to come back after doing Bercy so many years, mm-hmm. from 87, you know, I mean, I'm talking 6-7 years later, my wife and I, we're driving one day from Vegas, because I was living in Vegas at the time, to SoCal, where she has a friend.
Just like LeBig. You really were
LeBig. I was LeBig before LeBig.
Yeah, LeBig looked at your life and said, well, Eric lived in Las Vegas, so I must go there.
Yeah, I told him to move to Vegas when he moved to U.S., and he said no, he could never move there because there was too much temptation. Mm. So, fortunately, he didn't listen to me.
So
we were driving to SoCal, and my wife said, why don't we do a Bercy in America? And I have to say, that was kind of a genius idea. And we were driving the typical 4 hours to SoCal, or 5 hours, and we talked about it. And that was the first step of what would become the U.S. Open 3 years later, you know.
Yeah.
So once this seed was in the ground, you know, it was just a matter of watering it and make sure the tree would grow.
Right.
And it took a long time, because one thing I realized about Bercy is the old real estate rule. It's location, 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 mm-hmm. you know. As much as I want to believe we do a great job, at the end of the day, if we were not in Bercy, it wouldn't be Bercy.
Right, Paris, so right in Paris.
Yeah, it's Paris. You know, it's Paris. Paris is the magnet. Not the stadium or the race. It's mm-hmm. people are very attracted to the place. So that, following that that fact that I learned pretty quickly, mm-hmm. I said Vegas is a place to do it. There was no question, but at the time there was no place like Bercy in Vegas. So, you know, I had heard about the MGM building. There were just a time when they were building MGM, and I heard about an arena. So, you know, I kind of became patient, which is difficult in your 30s, much easier now, and I waited for the MGM to be open, and I tried to put my foot in the door, which we all know 5,000 employee companies are not easy to penetrate, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tried to, when they opened, I tried to see them, and they had absolutely no interest. They were not interested in anything I could tell them.
Yeah, that was my main question, was how in the hell did you get those guys to agree to it?
Yeah, I mean, it took about 2 years, you know. I mean, all 95 and all 96 was, I was trying to put my foot in the door any way I could. So, you know, yeah, I was in Vegas. I was the biggest Yamaha dealer in Las Vegas. I mean, the biggest Yamaha dealer in Nevada, as a matter of fact, you know, in Henderson.
You were?
And on Desert Only Yamaha.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, that was my dealership. You know,
really?
That was what I was doing on my spare time.
we should talk more, because I don't know. This is all news to me.
Yeah, I worked a lot with Yamaha. From the Jackie Vimont time, I became one of Yamaha production company. I organized convention for Yamaha, big ride for Yamaha, adventure travel for Yamaha. Oh, and one day I had the opportunity, while I was organizing a convention for Yamaha, they told me they were looking for a dealer in Las Vegas. So being the crazy entrepreneur that I am with my wife, a month later we had bought a piece of land on Boulder Highway in Henderson, you know, in Las Vegas, and we were starting building a dealership, you know.
Wow.
And we built one of the biggest exclusive Yamaha dealer in America, and it still is a big place. It's moved now because it was too small.
Yeah.
time once again was an issue. But at the time, I'm the Yamaha dealer for Las Vegas, basically.
Okay.
You know,
so.
And I've got a production company that organizes all the Supercross in Europe. And I've got another production company that does a lot of motorcycle travel for Yamaha. We have 30 bikes, you know, 5 trucks, and we're taking basically European Yamaha customers all over U.S. on a 7-8 months a year.
Oh, wow.
And in the middle of that, I want to create the U.S. Open.
which I can just imagine how that went. Hey, MGM, this is what I want
yes.
to do.
And so, you know, the key was to who you know.
Right.
And I basically was using, every time somebody was telling me he was in the casino industry, I was asking, hey, do you know people at the MGM? Do you know people? So, you know, I kind of built a little network. I finally got to know a few people that were in the right places, you know, just like when you move to Vegas, you know, you have to know people, you know.
Right.
And finally, I run into a guy I knew for many, many years, a guy named Mike DiStefano. He was Mike Goodwin, vice president or something like that. And in 96, he was doing the famous Fukuoka Supercross, which was the last Japanese Supercross.
Okay.
You know, because sadly, it was the last Japanese Supercross.
Mm-hmm.
And we became good friends. I went to Fukuoka in 96, and I just told him, I said, hey, I've got this concept. I want to create a Bercy type race in U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do it at the MGM, at the Grand Arena, blah, 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 blah. He said, I think I know the general manager there.
Really?
You know, because from his time, you know, the guy was much older than me, and he had worked with, you know, today I know 50 building managers.
Yeah.
In 95, I knew zero.
Right, exactly. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Now it's time to pay some bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at BTOsports.com.
So, it was interesting in a way that you say, yeah, I think I know the guy. So I say, hey, get us in. So he got us in. We suited up. You know, I mean, it was funny because we definitely suited up, tie and everything, because that's the style.
Right.
And I went there with a VCR, I mean, a VHS tape of Bercy, you know. Put it in the small TV, the guy, the president had in his office, and say, hey, I want to do that. And the guy say, okay, let's do it.
Really, huh? He was all...
It was like, you know, it was, let's do it. It was a go. And I got out of the building with Mike DiStefano, and we looked at each other and said, man, that was easy.
Really? Oh, wow. I would still think it would be a massive... You know, a massive fight, but no, the guy saw the tape and he was all about it.
Yeah, he said, yeah, you know, we need motorsport in the building. Something happened 2 months prior to our meeting that was a big turning point. Is Honda did their dealer meeting at the MGM.
Ah, okay.
And they had brought dirt in. So the MGM had lost its dirt virginity.
Yes.
two months before. And Dirt Works did a great job. They made it really clean, mm-hmm. and helped out the situation tremendously. I think if somebody would have done the Honda convention 2 months earlier and messed up the building, yep. I think they would never be in an MGM US Open.
you were like, oh, and by the way, those chainsaws without the blades, we'll keep those out. Those will be out.
Exactly. Exactly. But we'll try the horn. But, yeah, okay, it's not legal. We can't do the horn, too. Okay, forget
yeah.
the horns.
Yeah, forget the horns. Forget the chainsaws.
Air horns.
Okay, so U.S. Open, you're set to go at the MGM. And now what? Now where do you start?
Now what is the MGM was very kind, but not that kind.
Uh-huh.
And they told me, hey, you guys are pretty nice. You're pretty young. Mike, we know him. We need basically some serious funding here. We're not going to take a chance with you guys.
Yeah.
So at that point, we needed to find sponsors. We needed to find a ton of cash to basically bankroll the thing before,
yeah.
because they were not willing to take a risk, you know. And I, you know,
yeah.
don't blame them,
right.
you know. They said, if you want to do a show with us, it's going to be all the cash, all the ticket sales are going to go in our pocket. Everything's going to go in our pocket, and we'll pay you after. So that was the next challenge.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, that's usually the way it would be done with a promoter, with a fly-by-nine promoter. You
yeah,
know,
yeah,
I mean,
if
you're a Clear Channel, of course, they don't have the same rules.
Yeah, but
if you...
Some guy from Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, a French guy and a semi-retired Mike Goodwin executive is
yeah.
maybe not the best.
Yeah, exactly.
What we did, we were starting to get a little bit tired of the dealership with my wife, so we kind of discreetly put it on sale, and it sold very quickly. So that solved all the cash issues we could have had.
Wow, that's a big deal. You must have really believed in this. That was
oh yeah. I mean, it was definitely the biggest gamble of our life. It was pretty amazing. And I went for sponsors that I selected. I kind of like purposely went completely out of the way of the regular sponsors. Like, I went to Fox because Fox was not in the Supercross, and I sold them on the project, and they
right.
were an extremely good supportive team. I mean, they did fantastic things with us, and I'm still very grateful of our friendship. And I even went to Microsoft. I went through some... Microsoft was actually sponsoring the U.S. Open, you know.
Yeah.
Which, we through some family ties, I even got Revlon to sponsor the U.S. Open.
Oh,
so,
wow. right.
you know, and so we had a really good panel of different sponsors. Mm-hmm. And all 96, beginning of... All 97 was basically working on the U.S. Open, and I think we kept the best-kept secret in the industry. We had absolutely no leaks.
Yeah.
There were 10 people in the world knowing it, and we wanted to make a big splash. We
mm-hmm.
wanted to make sure that we would not have a chance to be damaged or, you know,
yeah.
We wanted to make sure we'd be completely ready. It was a shock and awe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I was down here by then, so I can attest
yeah.
to that. So how were the riders and OEMs when you went to them and said, hey, will you race my race?
Everybody was very supportive.
Yep.
Everybody was very supportive. We had the typical political BS, which you know, we want to forget that stuff because it's not very, you know, positive in our world on a daily basis. But, you know, overall, everybody was very supportive. I flew to Yamaha, went to see Honda, Suzuki, and everybody was, Mitch was a big supporter of it, you know, from the get-go. Mitch was one of the first one to know. And he said, okay, we'll be there, you know, we'll support you. And everybody was, it was kind of a, you know, David versus Goliath.
Yeah.
You know, it was like everybody knew me. I had a lot of good friends, you know, already. Everybody wanted me to succeed. You know, it was just as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
And we launched the U.S. Open at Sam Boyd, 97, you know. I remember putting flyers on the parking lot and all that stuff. And And the buzz that went with it was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I do remember mid-July, 2 months later, the MGM, the president of the arena called me and said, Eric, I've got some news for you. There's no ticket for sale left.
Really? Yeah, yeah. So.
And it was, we're talking seven figures worth of tickets.
Yeah, because the tickets weren't cheap. I definitely remember that. I don't know who set the ticket prices, but so that's even more impressive. They were a good.
We were the first $100 tickets. It was. I have to say the Fox brothers were so involved with me that they wanted to make a statement. Like motocross could also bring people willing to pay $100. And I was, I'm a grassroots guy, and I was like kind of arguing them and say, I want the show to be affordable. I want $35, $40, $50 tickets.
Right.
And Pete and I, we had a good conversation. He said, hey, please, just put some $100 tickets.
Right.
So we finally, when we did the scaling, we agreed to put some, it was like maybe $1,100 tickets.
Right.
They sold like hotcakes.
Yeah, it was just a big.
they were the fastest one to sell, so it was amazing.
It was it was an event at that point. You know what I mean?
Yes,
it was an event.
Exactly.
It was I gotta go. Yeah.
Exactly, and everybody was there. No riders. Ricky Carmichael never missed a US Open. He did it. I mean, he did like 10 of them. It's
right.
Pretty amazing. People, like Jeremy had years off or whatever, but Ricky never missed one. And I've been friends with Ricky since 95. So it was always the race he wanted to win because he could see how much better he was from year to year.
Yeah. So you throw the race, two-night race. It is a success. It sells out. You pay $100,000 purse, which is unheard of.
We pay $300,000 purse altogether.
Yeah, $300,000. $100,000 to the winner. And at the end of the weekend, on Saturday night, you're just letting out a sigh of relief, I guess? It worked?
I mean, originally it was different. It was Saturday night and Sunday afternoon.
Oh, was it? Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yep. And it was, we never knew what was the best. It's kind of like, is it better to do Friday, Saturday, or Saturday, Sunday?
Right.
At the end of the day, we don't know. It was just the right race at the right time at the right place. The stars were lined up. We had won the biggest gamble of our life. I don't think we've gambled anything bigger since.
I would agree that was a big gamble. But
yes. It was very exciting times. Sadly, we had some issues with the pace people at the time. It was the beginning of that relentless AMA Supercross war.
Yeah, yeah.
We got to be a casualty of war right away because the AMA had sanctioned the race as a Supercross, and in their own book, a Supercross was to be in front of 30,000 spectators. I mean, 30,000 seats. So basically, you couldn't call a Supercross unless you were at Sam Boyd. Sam Boyd is about the smallest size Supercross defined by the AMA.
Right.
And
you guys really wanted the name Supercross because that's what people identified with. You didn't want to call it an arena cross.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Because we didn't have the arena cross guys. We had the Supercross guys, and Supercross was being from Europe, there's no such thing as arena cross. Yeah, arena cross doesn't exist in Europe.
Point,
as soon
right.
as you put dirt in a living room, it's a Supercross.
It's a Supercross. Yeah. All right, let's get to that in a second. But so was it highly profitable for you at the?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was, and it was not the goal. I mean, I have to say, much as I was very happy to make the money we made, the goal we did it as a challenge. It was something a year before, everybody would have been signing on the dotted line saying, we'll break even.
Right. Yeah, you're like, hey, just don't make me lose money.
Exactly. Because we thought it was so good for the sport because the exposure was so good for the sport. We brought so much, and I say we because it's obviously you don't do that alone. You had a lot of great people, that helped. And we brought so much to the sport from the pageantry, you know, from having Lyle Lovett singing the national anthem I mean, we had so many people in we don't even know at that stage how many stars were here watching the race, you know, as far as spectators and it was really fantastic. It changed the world of Supercross because after that, pageantry became obvious. You know, like funny enough, you know, we used lasers and all that stuff. And then a year later, it was normal procedure to do that. You know?
I know, absolutely. I remember being impressed with the because I had never been to Bercy at that point, so I had no reference point. But yes, it was very impressive as a mechanic. You know, I was like, wow, this place. You know, they're serious here. And I imagine MGM was on board ASAP with another one. I mean,
I mean, there was no question. There was a great relationship. I mean, they were very impressed with what we've done. I mean, considering that we were amateurs.
Right. And so now getting back to the Pace SRO, I don't know how much you want to get into it, but how bad did they not want you to have that race?
Oh, they were. It was mixed feeling. They were very impressed with what we did, you know. And there was admiration and resentment at the same time, you know, because they were fighting, you know, the AMA. We gave them, you know, fuel for their fight, and they were basically suing us. Which to me was very strange to be sued, but it's the good old American way. You sue everybody and then you look later. It's kind of like you shoot first and you ask questions later, you know, and they were suing us for using the word Supercross, but I'd pay a substantial amount of money to use that word because the sanctioning fee was very high.
Right.
You know, we're talking, can buy a very nice car for the sanctioning fee we gave the AMA, you know, so it was very confusing. It was kind of like it was the end of innocence, you know, if you see what I mean. We started to realize, like, we did something great. We were very successful, but suddenly we were in a field like, oh wow, this is pretty nasty around here. People are really. It's not all about the sport.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. You were like, hey, this is awesome. What could possibly be wrong with this event? And all of a sudden, it was. There's actually a lot that people aren't happy about.
Yes. So, you know, things went on. We went to a lot of you know, situation. The Las Vegas court was becoming mine. I was alternating between going to the MGM and going to the courthouse in Las Vegas. You know, it was really tiring. I don't know if you've been in a court case. It's it's really taking your blood away. Mm-hmm. You know.
And it was all over the name, Supercross.
It was all over the name. Yeah. You know, of course, there's always a positive throughout all the courts and all the discovery and all all the time we had. We ended up pretty good friend with Gary Becker. Gary Becker was a CEO of Pace at the time, you know. And we started to become friendly with each other after court. We're going to have a drink and talking. And he was pretty animate about his position. You know, he was clearly stating that he was not happy about it, about what was going on. And I was not able to convince that we were a casualty of war. You know, I say, no, you have to stop calling it Supercross. You know, you have to call it Arenacross or whatever. I'm like, can't do that. And I don't know how it happens, but at some point, Gary said, hey, you know, if you want, I'll buy it from you, you know, and we'll do it together.
And what?
And I'm like,
what year, how many U.S. Opens had you run, or was this after the first
year? I ran it already two. You know, and so it was in 2000 that when that came up, you know, and I was kind of surprised. My partner and I, and my wife was my always partner, we kind of like said, you know, it's been so fun to do it, but it's not so fun to run it the way it is. Because, and no offense, it was the AMA was really scary at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they would have sold us down the river in a minute. You know, it was really some bad times, and I can say that freely because none of the guys that are today were there. You know, but it was really scary at that time. There was a major crisis.
I think
there.
I think we see now 10 years with basically the dissolve. How do you say with the AMA dissolving? Let's just say that I lost my word.
Yeah.
With the AMA resolving here, 10 years dissolving. 10 years later, I think we can see what kind of management they sort of run. AMA Pro Racing is non-existent, and it's just a shell of what it used to be. So, I mean.
Yep.
In the end,
so,
I think you're proven right a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, we met in Tampa because at the time we had bought a house in Florida, so we were commuting between Florida and Las Vegas.
Right.
And we met with Gary Becker in Tampa at the Supercross, and we had the typical Denny's meal at next to the stadium, and we basically said let's do it.
Right.
And I said, you just send us an offer, we tell you if it's reasonable, and we move on. And I'm not much of a bargainer, so the offer came, and I said, that's fair. And
Eric, it probably had a lot of zeros on it.
It was not bad. It was not bad.
Well, I mean, as it should be. Hey, you this was your baby. This was your concept.
Yeah, and it was very successful. It was, it turned out to be the race that was paying the riders the most.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out to be also a very successful race.
Yeah,
on the promoter side. So it showed that you can do both.
Right.
You can take care of the riders and also make money.
Well,
but maybe not every weekend, but at least time to times.
I do remember that a lot of people on the inside were complaining about your purse because the riders were turning around and saying, how can this guy pay us this money with I don't know, what, 9,000 people?
Yeah, I mean 10,000 seats.
10,000 seats. How can this guy pay us this money and you have stadiums selling out with 40,000, 50,000 and your purse money is a shell of, like, that was a bit of a political tightrope.
Yeah, and that was not what we were trying to expose,
right.
But that's definitely made people look at it in a different way. But at the same time, you do one local race, you don't have 10 semis on the road carrying equipment, 50 people,
mm-hmm.
Full time. It's a different game,
Yeah.
I mean, it's a one-off race is definitely not run the same way as a full-time operation. Full-time operations are very expensive.
Absolutely. And not only did they buy the race from you, and you ran it. You actually ended up working for them as,
yes,
I guess, the World Supercross.
Gary Becker and Charlie Mancuso made me vice president of international business.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I became an executive, and I was basically based in Chicago, even though I was in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I was going there quite often, and I have to say I had three good years. I had three good years working with those guys. I was pretty happy about getting the World Supercross going. We did the race in Geneva, the one in Holland, the one in Spain.
Yeah,
when we went as
Factory Yamaha, I was working for Timmy then.
You
were really the guy on site that was handling everything. Like, if anybody had a question, you were the guy.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So.
Oh, that was my baby. I mean, that's
right.
When we went to Europe, it's, I took all the good guys from Clear Channel at the time and basically trained them around Europe, showed them the rope, how it was done there, and everybody did a great job. It was great fun, but it was, I had some personal issue at that time. My dad was passing away, I mean, he had cancer, and that kind of removed a lot of fun in my life.
Oh, okay.
And he passed away at the end of 2002, and in 2003 we had the war, and Charlie decided to basically be careful with international business.
Mm-hmm.
Rightfully so. He said, we have to put it a little bit more on the back burner because there's a lot of shit going on, forgive my French.
Right.
And at that point I said, I need to take some time off. So I basically resigned from my job in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
After working three full years with those guys, and took the summer off with my family, and we went to Alaska and a lot of good places, kind of like to recharge the batteries,
a little sabbatical.
Yes, exactly. And when I got back, I started to think about ideas, and the situation was pretty much stale. There was nobody wanting to do much stuff overseas. So, you know, I was done with my Clear Channel experience. Mm-hmm. We still had a good relationship, but I had this project in mind, which was the Endurocross.
Right.
And it's a project that I shared many times with my friends at Feld now. And I said, we should do this, we should do that. That's really an interesting concept, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, people were not overly excited about it. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. But, I, you know, all the time I had off
They should have listened to you. You made the U.S. Open. They should have said, hey, maybe this
Yeah,
maybe
but
this
that's not the way it works. You know,
this,
it's sometimes people think you only have one good idea in your life.
They should have been like, hey, maybe this kooky French guy, maybe he's on to something here.
Yeah. And so we talked about it, and I felt like there was a potential. I felt like the off-road world was misrepresented. Mm-hmm. There was nothing that was showing the real talent of the off-road stars. And, you know, that was all the concept of Endurocross. It's, mm-hmm. it's a supercross for off-roaders. So time went on, and I worked on the concept. I went to see some Spanish friends in Barcelona that do the indoor trial, and they had an indoor enduro, mm-hmm. which was kind of what inspired me, you know, because you always need to be inspired by something. No ideas come completely alone. You know, you need to have a triggering point. And I saw what they were doing, and it was too pure, too enduro, too European in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to work on a concept that is more a combination of enduro and supercross. And, mm-hmm. you know, I trademarked the name Endurocross, you know, and in 04, we did the first Endurocross in Las Vegas, which was not as successful as the U.S. Open. We did at the Orleans, and we had a fantastic time. Ryan Hughes won the first one, which was fantastic. We had one of those Jeff Emig moments when Jeff Emig won the U.S. Open. You know, he was basically, you know, people were retiring him already, and Rhino won the Endurocross when people were already counting him out, you know.
Right.
So that was one of those emotional moments which we'll never forget. And but I have to tell you, the sheer joy to have created that race was superior to the U.S.
Really?
Open, because we felt so good. The electricity was so good. There was no politics. Everybody was embracing us, saying, it's a great show, let's do it.
Right.
That we really felt excited. You know, I was partnering with Tim Clark at the time. Tim had been my he was my marketing guy for the U.S. Open when we owned it.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, when I do something on my own, you know, we can partner up. So he was my partner.
Right.
And we were extremely, extremely stoked about the Endurocross. And then the following year, it was a big sellout. And then it was another big sellout. And then it became to be three races.
Right.
And then suddenly we got approached by a company named Primedia at the time, was owning Dirt Rider magazine and mm-hmm. plenty of other magazine, and they said they were interested into purchasing it. And and a couple of years ago, we sold it to that publishing group known as Source Interlink Media.
Did I know that? I don't think I knew that. Did I know you sold?
You're learning a lot. That's good.
I am. I gotta say, if anybody's listening that hasn't been to an Endurocross, is it Endurocross.com? Can they go? Is that where they go for the
Endurocross.
Schedule?
Endurocross.com. Yes.
You gotta check this out, because I'm not an off-road guy, but an Endurocross is nonstop excitement and action. My wife, she probably will kill me if she hears this, but she actually prefers Endurocrosses to Supercrosses at this point. Like, it is. Everywhere you look, there's something going on. Somebody's falling. Somebody's doing something amazing. It's a really good show.
You should love your wife for that. She's right.
I mean, it is. I got to say, if anybody's listening, they got to make it out to one of these or catch them on TV or something.
They're starting this week on Versus Channel. We're going to have the six races, and we'll have a Vegas final pretty much the day after. So, on Versus, if you look at endurocross.com, you'll learn where Versus is on in your area.
Wow.
So it's good TV for sure.
They carry NHL hockey, so I'm well aware Versus is 151 on my satellite. do you have anything to do with it anymore?
I sold it with Tim. Tim retired very quickly from our purchasing organization, and I ended up running it for 2 years, up to mid 2009, and in June 2009, I resigned from Source Interlink and took my family for a promise I basically made to them a long time ago, which was to take them around the world for 1 year.
Yeah.
So last year in June, we left U.S. and just after the Colorado National, because it's I was at the Colorado National, mm-hmm. and then we left U.S. for a year. We went 12 months around the world, and
which you had a real cool blog that I was reading from time to time, and holy crap, man! What an ordeal that was.
That was a logistical nightmare. That was more difficult than organizing an Endurocross or the U.S. Open.
I bet. And your kids are how old? They're eight and
13 by the time we came back, and I had only three spectators, and they were very demanding for 1 year.
What was the scariest place you went to?
Oh, scariest place, none. Scariest thing, shark, cage diving with white sharks in South Africa.
Yeah.
Definitely an interesting moment. I'm not sure I would do it again.
Really?
But,
was that scary?
It's seeing that 15-foot shark trying to bite your cage, and seeing his teeth, like a few inches from your eyes. It's definitely a different experience than watching it on TV.
Really? Why are they trying to bite the cage?
Oh, because, I think because people are throwing blood and fishes around you to attract them.
Right, yeah. What about places?
Riding bikes in China was fantastic. Since I'm also involved with Minimoto, that was Tim Clark's creation, but became ours because we joined forces. Mm-hmm. I went to see a couple pit bikes factory in China, and they took me riding, and it was pretty interesting to be riding at a motocross track in behind factories pretty seedy neighborhoods in China.
And did you have any scary moments? Anything like, I got so many questions about that. Never mind the moto stuff. But what was that? I mean, when you were done, was it a case of, we're done? Like, whew, we're finally done with that?
The sad part is we really didn't have any scary moments. We didn't even have a flat tire out of driving 50,000 miles. Mm-hmm. We were followed by a lucky star. Our scariest moment was Luca, my little one, had a asthma crisis in Dubai, and we had to basically jet him to the emergency room and everything, and that was pretty scary. You know, Middle East, which is not that scary because it's a richer country. It's richer than U.S. And to be at 3 o'clock in the morning in a hospital with an 8-year-old that can't breathe, mm-hmm. is definitely a scary moment. I'm sure it would be as scary in U.S.
Yeah.
It's just not an experience that you want to duplicate. But it was interesting to have those moments because you definitely remember them clearly. The good news is everything was free because it's social medicine, so we didn't have to worry about paying at least. When we left, they say, "Oh, don't worry, don't worry about it." I say, "Okay, we will not worry about it." China and Mongolia.
Yeah.
When you get between China, Mongolia, and Russia, mm-hmm. Like in Siberia or parts of Mongolia, you really feel like you are far away from your world.
I would bet. Yeah,
the Russian you know, army, police is still looking pretty serious. Yeah, you still don't want to be, you know, mm-hmm. putting, you know, cracking jokes at that point, you know.
Yeah, well, I would think, like, you know, getting robbed or getting threatened or, you know, I mean, all of that would be scary.
No, we got pickpocketed in Peru for $40. I mean, it was $40. It could have been $500, but it was $40. Yeah. Bucks. And we had one encounter in Morocco with somebody that was aggressive, but it mm-hmm. was just verbal. And that was it. You know, it was it was pretty amazing. The world is a very nice place. You know, we definitely need to open our eyes. There's a lot of things going on, and you know, you can see China trying to be. China is definitely on the go. It's not a you know, media hype. It's happening.
Mm-hmm. I know. If you read some stories, they're soon going to be making everything for us.
Yeah.
You know. And
that would be a good place to start if I was a little bit younger and wanting to move there. I'm telling you, a place like that, you could start motocross, supercross. There's unbelievable things to do.
Yeah, wow.
People would be very appreciative of what we're doing. And one thing, to come back to what we do best, which is, you know, being part of the motorcycle industry, it's surprising when you go to 35 countries like we did, mm-hmm. how small the motocross footprint is. You know, motocross, to make motocross, you know, endurocross, supercross, whatever, you know, motocross is only a sport in North America,
mm-hmm.
France, Australia,
Belgium,
South Africa, and Europe,
yeah.
You know. Nowhere else. No, nobody can afford that sport anywhere else.
Yeah, yeah. Or they don't have the land or whatever. Yeah, the noise or who knows, you know?
Exactly. It's just, you know, only in those four places you're going to see a pickup truck going to a track with a motocross bike.
Yeah.
Other countries, don't even think about it, you know?
Hey, we had no U.S. Open this year for the first time since you started it.
Yes.
A little bit of sadness on your part?
Yes. I mean,
you still feel connected to that race, I imagine, right?
It's sadness. It's the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Stupid, as somebody said. And some things have to give. And, you know, I was having a Starbucks a couple months ago with Johnny O. And Johnny is a great friend. And he said, Eric, you can't look at it that way. He said, look, it's like a great TV show. It's been lasting 12 years.
Right.
And if you were in Hollywood, you know, anything that lasts 12 years is a giant success. You know,
but
for some reason we wanted to make it last forever. You know, and I think it will come back in some. I mean, not like I created it, but it will come back in some ways. You know?
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, you still feel very attached to that race. Every year you went, you probably were like, this is my dream.
And I didn't go the last 5 years because you got to a point where you say, you know, you don't want to be sour about it, and it's not done like you would do it or I would do it, so you'd rather stay away from it than whine about it.
Well, that was one of my questions. What would you do to make that race more successful if you had to do it over or do it in this time? Constructively, what do you think?
I would make it very international.
Mm-hmm.
Very international. That would be my key advice. I would try to bring all the talents from the world. You know, in that kind of like we always did with the Bercy,
mm-hmm.
but it lost that that connection years ago. You know, like Purcell, the last U.S. Open I directed, I brought Purcell at 12 years old. Because he was the Ken Roczen of his time in Europe. You know. So that was the kind of things that I would have done more and more, like always trying to find those newcomers,
mm-hmm.
those rising stars, and trying to bring them in.
Right.
And that's what I would do again. I would try to find the next Australian star, the next French star, the next South African star, and try to bring them to the U.S. Open to display them in the right environment where everybody can see them in a bright light. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. And like Johnny O said, who knew Johnny O was so wise? It's just time. Maybe, you know, I mean, definitely the glamour and the glitz had wore off. It's 12 years, you know. I mean, we kind of know what we're going to get when we show up at a U.S. Open, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, timing is everything. Mm-hmm. After location, location, location.
Yeah.
You know, when 98, people have to remember, 98, the Southwest was starved. Anaheim was being rebuilt. Mm-hmm. You know, there was one race at the Coliseum, mm-hmm. you know, in 98. The Phoenix Supercross didn't exist because they were building the stadium.
That's a good point.
You know,
yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And there was no San Francisco. You know,
right?
They were basically Coliseum, Las Vegas, and here I was in the middle.
Yeah,
you know?
And Glen Helen, and Glen Helen.
Yeah, but that's I'm talking stadium.
Yeah.
You know, stadium races. Yeah. You look at it 10 years later, you have three Anaheim, you have San Diego, you have San Francisco, Phoenix, Oakland. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's completely different animal.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, you're right. And yeah, I mean, as a Southern California fan, you can only see Jeremy McGrath three times. So
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Let's end up going there. You know, one time I did one of these with Jeff Stanton. And an unbelievable fact to me is that Stanton told me he made more money in the off season than he did from his Honda contract.
Absolutely.
And he said that that's one of the reasons he feels he retired so early, because it truly was a 365-day-a-year job. What happened to all those races? Is it just economy? Just
It's it's funny because we were talking about that yesterday with some big people in our industry, which I'm not going to name, but it's kind of like we went too big, where even the U.S. Open was a casualty of that.
Yeah.
Underground was fantastic in 98. In 2007, people were saying, fuck, I make 100 grand, sorry for swearing, but I make 100 grand, you know, every weekend.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah. That's a good point.
And that did hurt the U.S. Open,
mm-hmm.
you know, because suddenly the luster of the purse was not that big. But as I was saying yesterday, I say, you know, I'm telling you, in 2010, it's a shame we don't have the U.S. Open, because 100 grand would be quite appealing to a lot of guys.
Yeah, we really, I mean, at the height of Jeremy, he was getting 100,000 to start Bercy. Was that... Is that
give or take.
Okay,
give or take. Yeah, I mean that's. I'm not gonna say the precise number, but that's
okay,
pretty much in a range.
Yeah. So I mean, that was we kind of lost our innocence there a little bit too. You
exactly.
Know what I mean? Like all of a sudden these guys were getting that much. The big guys were getting that much to show up. You know, lights riders are getting $500,000 in a base contract salary.
I know. And that's what made the U.S. Open lose a lot of momentum,
mm-hmm.
is, it was becoming like, do I go, do I stay? The money was not the factor, not like it was the only factor, but it was a big factor. I mean, that $100,000 payday, I'm telling you, Damon Hoffman and Jeff Emig, they didn't have that every day.
No, absolutely. No,
I mean, Ricky Carmichael, when he won in 2001, you know, that was a big check for him for one day, you know. It turned out to be, you know, 6-7 years later, he was almost making that every weekend.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. So,
But in 2001, it was big.
So guys like Stanton and Larry Ward and all that, I mean, that's why you would see this regular European haul.
Today in Europe, if we had 6 or 7 races, you know, because the rider's fee killed the European races.
Yeah.
Because the European fans wanted to see the big guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the big guys became so expensive, only the richest races survived,
right,
meaning
right.
the three we have today.
Yep.
You know, in order, it's Paris, Geneva, and Genoa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those three races are the three oldest, by the way. You know, I mean, Genoa was the first one, Paris was the second one, and Paris and Geneva, Switzerland was the third one.
Bercy was 84, I believe?
Yes, and Genoa was 82. I was there. I was in Genoa for their first Supercross in 82, you know.
Same place? Was it in the same place?
Same place.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are we coming back around, and in 2 years we're going to see these races pop back up as riders realize that, hey, I can get 10,000, 20,000, and that's awesome? Is that what's going to happen?
You know, sadly, I don't think so, because the economy is so challenged right now that I don't think many people are going to take the chance to, you know, promoting a race is a very substantial challenge. You know, I mean, renting a stadium costs a lot of money. You know, I mean, it's producing a race like the U.S. Open was extremely, it was close to a million 10 years ago.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't get too many people willing to take that chance.
Yeah, and actually, you know? if you read about the economy, the state of concert tickets has gotten out of hand, too.
Exactly.
Concert tickets to go see your artist is $250 now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe like you said, everything's just gone through the roof.
Yeah, you know, I'm not saying it cannot change, but it's going to take all the people that quit, you know, the Madrid, the Milano, the, you know, the Barcelona, they have to realize today that they can maybe get top guys again for less money than they were, because they got to the point where, you know, most of the good guys were costing $100,000 a weekend, and that is a lot of money.
Right, right. Are we at the point where the Endurocross guys are getting start money?
No. I mean, the off-road guys are very happy. I mean, they obviously wish they could make more money.
Of course.
And they make good money with the Endurocross, but it's part of their contract, and they have, you know, Endurocross today is like motocross was 20 years ago. I mean, everybody is friends with everybody. You know, nobody's talking about millions. They're all talking about making a living, doing what they love, and it's far from being very profitable. It's just holding its own, which is fantastic in today's environment.
Right, right. And I noticed that the schedule, you know, you went to Oklahoma City, you went to Denver. I imagine all on purpose, all to stay away from markets that have supercrosses. And then, so how was the attendance and how was that? All good?
You know, we went to Indy during MotoGP. We almost sold out 2 months ago. Last month, we went to Seattle.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that. Okay.
And Seattle sold out completely. Next week, we're going to Denver, and we've been selling out Denver for 3 or 4 years now. So it's going to be the fourth year in Denver. Vegas has been always sold out, but the first one, you know. So it's different. It's a different crowd. It's a different crowd.
Yeah.
It's rich. All the Supercross fans like it, but I don't think we've seen all the Supercross fans yet. You know?
Right, right, right. And it's a bummer for me because it looks like I might be going to Bercy, which is the date of the Vegas one.
I'll be with you in Bercy till Saturday morning, and I'll be flying back to Vegas Saturday
really?
Morning.
Yeah.
Yep.
I like to think of you as a guy. Obviously, you've got your finger on the pulse of a lot what's going on behind the scenes. We've been up as an industry. We've been down. We're now at the point where a guy like Chad Reed. He might not race next year. It's very likely he doesn't race because he cannot find a deal that pays him enough. Where are we at? When's this getting better? Is this a good thing? Not a good thing that Chad Reed's not racing, but a good thing that everything's coming down? What's your sort of take on the industry right now?
You know, when I moved to U.S. in 85, you know, and worked for O'Neill, that was the last time we had such a dip. Funny enough, when you're in your 20s, you don't realize it as much, you know. It's everybody says this was as bad as now, but, you know, when I moved to U.S. in 85, I thought it was great.
You're like, sweet, the beach. And
exactly, you know. And, you know, comparing Chad Reed to Brad Lackey, Brad Lackey won the world championship in 84 and couldn't get a contract to his liking.
I think it was 82.
'83. That was kind of the same situation.
Yeah.
Where, you know, a rider elevated himself to such a level of income that he doesn't want to go down. And, you know, I have to say it's more power to them if they can afford it, you know.
Yeah. So,
but it's sad for the big picture, because that would be sad not to have Chad Reed racing, because Chad has still a lot of speed in him, you know.
Right. So... it's good.
Just like the situation with your ex rider, you know, I'm sure the the economy has to do, you know, has to be part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I mean, no, he had some offers, and he was like, nah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to see some riders that are, I mean, less willing to take chances for less money. I mean, it's...
Are you in agreement with me that something had to happen as far as the salaries? I mean, we did get out of whack, right?
Yes. I think it went too high because at the end of the day, it was not real money. It was subsidy money. You know,
right.
That's what I keep saying about, that's what, you know, you and I were talking about teams earlier. Mm-hmm. Sadly, motocross is not NASCAR yet. In NASCAR, you get $10 million for your team, you spend $8 million, everybody is happy, and the owner makes $2 million at the end of the year.
Right.
I don't think in motocross it's happening, and all the big salary were paid by subsidy from the manufacturers.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you know?
Right.
And when Ricky made the most money anybody made, most likely in motocross, it was Suzuki just putting the check on a global basis.
Yeah.
Which was fantastic for Ricky, but I don't think it did relate with the RM sales in US.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And even like clothing gear, I mean, you and I know what some of these guys are pulling down for clothes. How many pairs? You can't sell that many pairs of pants and jersey. Like it's like you said, it's fake money. It's not even real.
Yep.
You know, you're pulling it from somewhere else.
Exactly. Oh. Like a big company, they, you know, I don't have an example, you know, like a company that are purely in motocross. We know the money is coming out of motocross.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I'm not so sure the return on investment is wise. Mm-hmm. in many cases.
Yeah.
But you know, it doesn't seem like the companies are going bankrupt, so it's good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just seems like too we've lost the middle class of riders. Guys are riding for free, or they're getting paid a lot of money.
Exactly. Like we have few riders making money, and the rest hopefully making a living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Well, Eric, what's next for you? What is next? Can I get in on it? Whatever it is.
Like you sure can. There's always space for good people.
Well,
you know.
What's going on with you? What's next on the horizon for you?
We have some pretty big news coming up from the Endurocross, but you're a few weeks early.
Okay,
so I have to. We will be able to do most likely a big announcement for next year's Endurocross soon, and I hope it will happen. But I'm not gonna jinx myself. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, evaluating a lot of projects right now, and I'm pretty serious. A lot of projects, and with caution and. Mm-hmm. And trying to see when the dust settled, because I don't think the dust has been settling yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's still not a clear track. We still have a lot of dust. You know,
and so you're content right now with just sort of being the point man for the Endurocrosses.
Yes, basically, I'm a consultant for the Endurocross. I'm doing a couple European races, you know, as you well know, and that is not enough for my brain. I need more, but I don't want to be reckless and do things for doing things. You
know? Right. Well,
that wouldn't be me. So I'm not going to be, you know, I'll be careful and you know. I'll try to be the careful rider instead of the reckless one.
I think I know what your Endurocross plans are. I think I know what it is. You're planning on dusting off that giant hand from Bercy and bringing Ricky Dietrich out in it. Is that it?
If I could find that hand, you know, that was the best thing we ever had. So we need to find it again.
That was so cool. I wish I know when I went to Bercy the very first time in 01, I was like, where's the hand? Where's the giant hand?
Yeah, that was the hand was perfect for Ricky Johnson, put it that way.
Hey, Jean-Michel Bale at his height, is that the loudest you've ever heard Bercy Stadium? I mean, is that...
You know, that's one thing. I think Bercy has been loud for. Bercy has so much respect for any champion,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a tad more when he's French.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they have much. It's, you know, it's one thing I realized with the U.S. Open is you can do everything. We did a lot of things in some ways better than Bercy, mm-hmm. but you can't buy the fans.
Yeah.
And the fans are it. I mean, if you look at the location and the fans, we're very, very fortunate, you know, to have because between the two, between the, being in the center of Paris and having fans that are so into it, it's just it's difficult to fail, you know.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. You're right about that. Best Bercy race you've ever seen. Is there one that sticks out?
No. There was definitely some craziness about the Bradshaw chicken, Matsevich, you know. Mm-hmm. The riders were way more aggressive in that time. Mm-hmm. You know, when we had Jason Lawrence, it was very entertaining, but I'm not so sure about liking it. The stories with, you know, Sorby and Mike Alesi were very entertaining as well.
Yeah. Well, Alesi,
we have a tendency to remember what was entertaining.
Alesi went over a berm and parked Porcel. Was that it? What happened?
I think he parked Tortelli and Sorby. No, he parked Quasi.
Okay.
He parked one of Sorby's friends.
Okay, and then so then
and Sorby had to be the new sheriff in town. You know.
but then I saw a video where fans were just hurling garbage onto the track at Alesi. Wasn't that?
Yeah, that was because of that situation.
Right,
you know,
right.
If you want to park a rider, don't park a world champion, you know, a French world champion.
And then was Lawrence's stuff on the track or off the track?
Both.
Oh, both.
It was nonstop. He was he had brought his mystery head, which I don't know who did it. We did the work. It was we keep supplying him every time he was riding a brand new Yamaha with his, you know, Jason Lawrence head. He was blowing up the engine, and he blew up three engines until Yamaha said, "We're not giving him another one. It's done." It's like if he wants to ride, he doesn't touch the bike. He rides it with a stock head, but he's not gonna put his evil head
yes.
on our engine. And that was going with a lot of drama because you know Jason. You know, nothing is simple with Jason.
Yeah, I know exactly. Wow, man, you should write a book, Eric.
Yeah, maybe we should do it together.
Yeah,
we
there
could.
We yeah. should. We yeah. should write a book about you because you've led a very interesting life and always a great guy, always classy and friendly and a friend of motocross. I really, when I was thinking about what to write, what to introduce you as, that was what came to mind.
I love it. Thank you so much for thinking that way. But that's my goal.
Yeah.
Trying to do things, make things better, and you know it's. You know what? Keep trying.
yeah. No, really. I hope people find this interesting. I know. I think they will. You're one of those guys that's been around and done that. And like I said, man, you could definitely write a book. Well, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve, and glad to spend some time with you. Get back to me soon. We need to get you going to Paris.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for being on the BTOsports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast Show.
All right. Take care.
See ya.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show brought to you by Transworld Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. And, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course, everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled fifth and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you'd sit there if you didn't even want to ride it. You just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die. You know I've got this bad up in the atmosphere.